Members, the hour of 3 o'clock having arrived, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We do not quite have a quorum yet. Should have pulled this up. House File 1418 will be first up on the agenda. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr, hang on just a second. Did we have one, two, three, four, five, six? Okay, we're not quite at half quorum. So, Representative Barr, we're not going to move your bill right now, but go ahead and do the, by the time you're done talking about it, I think we'll have a quorum here, and then we'll properly move it and send it on its way.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Barr, to your bill.
Thank you, Representative Chair and members. The bill before you today is House File 1418. And it's the Minnesota Lottery's technical policy bill. And this bill seeks to accomplish two things. First, it would remove obsolete language from statute that deals with awarding lottery prizes to persons under the age of 18. And this was something that came out of the recent OLA report on the lottery. And secondly, it seeks to clarify the lottery's statutory budget cap as it relates to the lottery's operating expenses, and more specifically, pension reporting under Rule 68 from the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB. With me today are representatives from the lottery that can further explain the bill in more detail. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Kwapik.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Mr. Kwapik, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is Chris Kwapik, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Lottery. As Representative Barr mentioned, House File 1418 is the lottery's technical policy bill and seeks to address two issues. I'll begin with the first issue laid out in sections 1 and 3 of the bill. In the state of Minnesota, it has always been illegal for any person under the age of 18 to purchase a lottery ticket. However, prior to 1994, a person under the age of 18 could claim certain lottery prizes. In 1994, the legislature decided to end this practice, and all prize claimants had to be over the age of 18. They amended Minnesota Statutes 349A.12 to prohibit minors from purchasing or claiming a lottery ticket or prize. In that 1994 bill, however, there was an oversight which forgot to repeal a reference to this under 18 provision in 349A.08, which governed how to pay a prize to a person under the age of 18. Our bill simply seeks to clean this up by removing this reference from statute. And just to be clear with the committee, the lottery has not paid out a prize to a person under the age of 18 since 1994 and has been in full compliance with the law ever since. The second issue our bill addresses is in Section 2. In 2012, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, issued Statement 68, which required that beginning in fiscal year 2015, all government entities must provide in their year-end statements measurement and disclosure for employer-provided pensions. The goal of GASB 68 was to increase transparency in these statements. The lottery does not have an issue with the disclosure in general. However, our financial division has concerns about the way this disclosure relates to our legislatively mandated operating budget cap. As members may recall, our agency is unlike other state agencies in our means of funding. We do not receive general funds, but instead operate from proceeds from the sale of our tickets. Every 2 years, the legislature sets a cap for what the lottery can spend on its operations, which includes salaries, office leasing, advertising, promotion, and other supplies and materials. And for the past 2 years, this cap has been set at $31 million. The concern that we have are possible market fluctuations on pension liabilities that could have a perceived impact on the lottery's bottom line when it comes to the operations cap. These fluctuations can result from a change in actuarial assumptions used to calculate the pension liability, or from changes in the performance of the stock market from actuarial expenses from year to year. To be clear, this is a non-cash item. We do not put money in or take money out of this line item. And is no impact on the lottery's or its employees' contribution to MSRS run by the state of Minnesota. If members of the committee, if you wouldn't mind sharing your attention, the handout that I believe should be in your packet with the logo on top, it gives an example of the scenario that we're talking about. As you can see, in fiscal years 15 and 16, fluctuations actually show less liability for the lottery, which resulted in lower reported operating expenses. It makes us seem more efficient than we are, and which in all honesty we wouldn't mind, but we do want to be as transparent as possible. Our concern is the hypothetical situation for FY18, where fluctuations could go in the opposite direction. And even though our actual costs would be under that statutory cap, our bottom line in our end-of-the-year reports would give the perception that we are, in fact, over that cap. It's impossible to budget for these fluctuations because we don't receive these liability numbers until after the fiscal year concludes. So for fiscal year 17, which ends on June 30th of this year, we won't receive these figures until sometime between July and October 2017. Therefore, it's our proposal in this bill that this pension liability line item be defined in statute to not be calculated as an operational cost so as to create further clarity on actual expenses. It's the lottery's intent to make sure that our end-of-the-year annual reporting is accurate and that a sudden fluctuation in a pension liability adjustment does not make it appear as if the agency has overspent the statutorily mandated operations cap. And as a side note to members, since this figure is not an actual expenditure, it has no impact on the lottery's contribution back to the state of Minnesota, this general fund, natural resource trust fund, game and fish fund, or the natural resources fund. So with that, Mr. Chair, I also have Joe Paul, who is the CFO of the lottery, here with me, and we're happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kwapik. Members, any questions? Mr. Paul, do you want to speak to the committee, or are you just here for...
Just here for questions.
Thank you. Anybody else in the audience that want to speak for or against the bill? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Representative Barr, thank you for carrying this bill. This needs to be done. I think it's really unfair to the lottery the way you're set up now. And so this bill needs to take care of that pension liability issue so it doesn't so you're not reaching any caps or anything.
Thank you, Representative Davids. With that, Representative Barr, we now have a quorum, so we can officially... I assume you want to move House File 1418?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
And since you moved it, we'll give you the final word.
Okay, thank you. This is a technical bill, and I would just ask for support and your vote in laying this over.
Thank
Actually,
you.
Actually, we're referring it, I think.
We're referring it to the Committee on State Gov Finance. With that, all those in favor of the Barr motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Kwapik. Thank you, Mr. Paul. Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Barr, do you want to stay there, and we'll see what we can do to help the NFL today?
Yes, thank you.
And I assume you want to move House File 1740?
Yes, and I will grab my notes and happily do that.
Okay, and we are going to hold this bill for possible inclusion in an omnibus liquor bill, should one be fortunate enough to pass the committee today.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Minnesota Vikings, as you probably know, are building their new practice facility and team headquarters in Eagan. And this 40-acre campus will include 6,000-seat outdoor stadium, offices, meeting rooms, indoor and outdoor training facilities, an orthopedic performance center, and the Vikings Hall of Fame and team store, in case you want to do any shopping. In addition to various Viking functions, it will also be available for nonprofit programming, community events, and other types of outreach. It's likely to host things like youth, college, and amateur sporting events, including high school football, soccer, and lacrosse, as well as outdoor activities like ice skating. In order to provide flexibility and have the option to provide hospitality at these events, the Vikings are seeking the opportunity to apply to the City of Eagan for a liquor license. Because the facility is unique, the city does need authorization from the legislature before they can consider issuing a license. This bill would give the city the option to issue a license, and if this bill should pass, the Vikings would still have to apply for a license and go through the city's licensing process. As background, the City of Eagan was involved in drafting this legislation, and there is a letter of support in your packet. A liquor license would allow the Vikings to host a variety of events at the site, like their draft party and Taste of the Vikings fundraiser, as well as bring in concessions for the stadium. Community events held there could also benefit from that option to provide this type of hospitality. So I think this is a very exciting project for my district and presents a great opportunity for developing a new community resource. So with that, I will answer questions or turn it over to our...
Thank you, Representative Barr. Mr. Bagley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Thank you, Representative Barr, for advancing this proposal. We'd like to obviously voice our support for this proposal to allow the Vikings to apply to the city of Eagan for a liquor license. You know, we're less than a year away from the opening of our new team headquarters and practice facility in Eagan, and as Representative Barr said, it's going to have some great community programming, the NFL draft party, Taste of the Vikings, which is a fundraiser for charity. So it's an opportunity for us to connect with the community and also to provide hospitality, food, and beverage at various events. So also happy to answer any questions. There's some background information in all of your packets. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Bagley. A number of committee members had the same question, so I'll ask it. Before you picked Eagan, was there another city that you were looking at for this facility? And if so, where was that city?
Careful now.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we were looking at a lot of cities,
uh-huh.
And we've had a great run in Eden Prairie, but there was just not the available property there, a good relationship with Eden Prairie. We did look west. We did look south.
Well, where was the city when you looked west? And whose district was that in?
Yeah.
Mr. Good Chair. Luck, Representative Barr.
So much for that, Bill.
Yeah.
Next, Bill.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bagley, you're leaving my district, and we'll miss you greatly, but we'll still come out and see you.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. And Representative Barr and Mr. Bagley and members, seriously, we do have a letter from the city of Eagan. We have to approve these for, and I don't think we've ever said no to one of these for any city, but we always keep in mind, as you said, this is only if the city of Eagan approves it, and we're happy to, I think, let it proceed and let the city act upon it as they will. Members, any other questions? Representative Halverson.
As another representative from Eagan, I just have to say welcome to the Vikings, and we're happy to have you. Sorry to everybody else who's missing them, but you're all invited to our community. And I do want to thank Mr. Bagley for the impact that the Vikings are already having on the community of Eagan. It's very clear that you're taking your presence in our community seriously and working hard to be a good partner with our city and with the citizens of our city. And we couldn't be happier, so thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. And Representative Halverson, we're happy that the Vikings are going to a new facility, but I just want to know what you did with Representative Loon, who represents Eden Prairie and was just sitting there. I guess no questions are probably better. Members, any other questions? Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? With that, Representative Barr will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I'm going to actually leave it with what Representative Halverson so eloquently said and just respectfully ask for your vote to lay this over.
Thank you, Representative Barr, and with that, House File 1740 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Liquor Bill. Thank you, Mr. Bagley. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative O'Driscoll, House File 1436. And while you're coming up, Representative Smith, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from our last meeting?
I did, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move those minutes.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves the minutes from our last meeting. Any questions, comments, corrections, concerns? Seeing none, those in favor of the Smith motion to approve the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Smith. Thank you, members. Representative O'Driscoll, to House File 1436.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 1436 be laid over for possible inclusion if there is a omnibus liquor bill that comes out of this committee this year. Not sure what our plans are, but I'm hoping for the best. Members, this is a bill that's being requested by the city of Sartell, which is in my district, and it's not unlike one we heard for the city of White Bear earlier this year, and other communities have in the past come forward. Under Minnesota law, municipalities are not allowed to issue themselves a liquor license for on-sale liquor without special legislative approval. The city of Sartell is a rapidly growing community, and we'll be bringing online later this year a community event center, and I should say a community center, which will be the place that many events in the community will be hosted. And there are also two other ballpark facilities that host many tournaments from in and out of the central Minnesota area. And members, what the city has attempted to do in the past is try to find private vendors to receive liquor licenses to be able to run liquor concessions, and for various reasons have not been able to be successful in that. And the city is asking for the opportunity to be issued a license, like some of the other cities in the area of central Minnesota, to be able to provide that hospitality and beverage option for legal consumption by those 21 years of age or older.
Representative O'Driscoll, thank you. Members, any questions? Anybody in the crowd that wants to speak for or against the liquor license option for the city of Sartell? Not seeing anybody. Representative O'Driscoll, nice job. And with that, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 1436 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you.
Representative Lunan, House File 1294. Representative Lunan, go ahead and move your bill whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you for hearing the bill. This bill is kind of straightforward, and it deals with protections for salespeople. And the problem we're trying to solve with this bill is companies that are located in another state that have salespeople located here in Minnesota are picking which state laws they want to use as far as enforcing the contracts they have with their salespeople. And what this bill does is says that if you're conducting business in Minnesota, while you're conducting business in Minnesota, you will adhere to Minnesota laws. And it does that fix by being a little more specific in its definition of what a salesperson is and who it applies to. And we are including, if you sell materials, components, or parts of a machine or mechanism or a product, that you have those same protections. And I have one testifier, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Ma'am, if you could identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Michelle Jobst, and I'm the owner of Jobst Incorporated. I'm a manufacturer's rep and located in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And I'm here on behalf of small business and manufacturer's reps. My whole job description is to get parts and components business for contract manufacturers, and I've become of this aware of this loophole that could mean that if I do my job, I might not get paid because it's being listed as to include materials and parts and components. So pretty straightforward. If we do our job, I can't see why we wouldn't get paid.
Seems to make sense. Members, any questions? Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against this bill? We're moving right along today. Representative Luna, nice work.
Does this bill go to the General Registry? Is that the next stop?
This bill goes to... You are correct, Representative Luna, to the General Register.
All right, members, in Texas, you can drive around with an open container of alcohol. And in Minnesota, of course, we aren't going to let somebody from Texas come up here and do that because we have different laws here. And this bill says when you're in Minnesota, we want to adhere to the Minnesota law. I appreciate your support.
Representative Luna, nice job. With that, Representative Luna renews his motion that House File 1294 be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Jobst. Thank you, Representative Luna. Members, nice job. Representative Lunan, do you want to stay there since you're there? And we'll go on to, I don't remember the number, House File 1012.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And again, thank you for hearing the bill. This is one of those sexy insurance bills. It has to deal with no-fault coverage. And it's got two pieces to it. And the two pieces are under no-fault, under the replacement services, which provides $200 a week if you are injured in a car accident, towards expenses for housekeeping, doing the dishes, mowing the lawn, things like that. What this bill says is that you can only collect that if you actually incur the expense. We've had rulings where people have not cleaned their house and came in and demonstrated that their house is dirty now, and someone has determined that, well, a dirty house is worth $200 a week. What we're saying here is the intent of the statute was to compel people to get those services so they have a healthier environment to heal. The second part of this bill has to do with a court ruling that occurred just within the last 2 years. And what happened is someone got injured in a car accident. The insurance company ordered an IME on the medical bills. We have problems with IMEs that we probably take a look at eventually. And terminated benefits, which happens over 90% of the time. The insured then is allowed to go to arbitration, which arbitration oftentimes overrules the IME, again, over 90%. So we've got kind of a circus going on there. Well, what happens is people have their no-fault benefits terminated under an IME. They then sue because they're able to and get made whole on their medical bills and their wage loss. Then, after they've been paid in full and now they no longer have a loss, come back and arbitrate their no-fault benefits and are collecting twice, which has never been the intent of insurance. And so it cleans that up. And, Mr. Chairman, I know it was longer than it should have been. I have one testifier.
Nice job, Representative Lunan. Ma'am, introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jessica Richardson. I'm an attorney at Stitch Angel Chrysler, Unke & Scattergood Law Firm. We practice in the area of personal injury defense. I've personally defended over 1,000 no-fault arbitrations. I also serve as an arbitrator through the AAA process. With regard to the replacement services piece, I would point out, just in addition to what Representative Lunan stated, that this has to do with services actually provided. Something has to be replaced. That's the only difference. And there is a difference in both the statute and the case law with regard to a person who is a primary homemaker. That person's not required to actually incur the expense. That is, they don't have to pay someone. But recent decisions say not only do they not have to pay, they don't even have to have anyone do it. So the change here just allows that those services have to be actually provided. The double recovery issue in the Section 2, Subdivision 1A, is completely consistent with the way the collateral source statute operates in most circumstances. In most circumstances, the person goes and has their makes a no-fault claim to the first-party insurance, makes the claim to their no-fault insurer.
You're doing fine. Sorry.
That's all right. Generally, if the no-fault insurer pays first, that's the purpose of the No-Fault Act, to encourage prompt recovery for those bills. And then a person goes and sues a tortfeasor in a third-party liability claim. What happens is, if those bills are awarded through that liability process, they're then subject to collateral sources, which means if they've already been paid through the no-fault system, they are then offset and not included in a judgment against the tortfeasor to be paid by a liability carrier or third party. The flip side currently is not true. As was pointed out, if a claimant chooses to proceed with the liability process first, which they certainly are entitled to do, if they do that and are awarded those bills under the Leonardson case from 2015, they are entitled to then go back and claim the exact same bills to their no-fault insurer and recover twice on the same bills. I would point out that the Supreme Court knew when they issued that decision that the result would result in unfairly rewarding no-fault claimants who strategically pursue a negligent action before a no-fault arbitration. That's Justice Anderson. It's a public policy concern, and he specifically wrote that the legislature should address this issue. I would point out something that I think is important to note, and that is that the language of the proposed change says that this applies if a claimant actually receives compensation for those bills. So to be clear, if a claimant was to go through a liability lawsuit and a jury did not award those bills or whatever process to obtain the liability recovery, that would not bar them from then going back and bringing the claim to their no fault. So it's not eliminating their chance. It's simply eliminating the possibility for double recovery of the exact same bills.
Sounds good to me. Somebody had a question. Representative Skwasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lunan or the testifier. So just kind of moving to that $200 a week actually provided, the process. So if I were to hire someone for 3 weeks, that'd be $600. If I issued a 1099 to that individual, would that be used as proof? Or what? How would I prove it? Or if I had an outside vendor, would I just simply take my bill that I received from them? Are there two different ways that I could do that?
It's a very low threshold. What comes in is a log that's created by the person who provides the services with their signature.
saying, I provided these services X number of hours, certain days a week.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. No other questions? Thank you, Ms. Richards. Mr. Richard Harden. Mr. Harden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Harden. I'm an attorney in Woodbury, Minnesota. I'm here this afternoon to testify in opposition to House File 1012. I'm here also on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Justice, my car crash clients, because I do practice in the personal injury area. And I hope that when I'm done, you may come to the conclusion that I'm also here testifying on behalf of the homemakers of the state of Minnesota. I'm here just to address the first provision that the bill seeks to change, and that is the primary homemaker benefit. I just want to point out at the outset that I believe Representative Lunin misspoke when he said that this bill is to eliminate a situation where the primary homemaker did not actually incur the expense. That's not what the bill says. The attorney testifier, and I'm sorry, ma'am, I forgot your name already, but she correctly pointed out that if you look at line 1.16 of House File Number 1012, what this bill really does is says that the primary homemaker cannot make a claim for the reasonable value of her services in providing the household chores if those services were not actually provided by someone. That's what the law here is about today. That's what this bill seeks to change. Let me share with you my view on why that's a bad idea. And we need in this situation to understand the difference in the terms expense incurred and loss incurred. Those are two separate concepts, and they're critical to understanding what this change would do. I like to use the analogy of someone who gets an fender bender and there's $500 of property damage to their vehicle. You go to the insurance company, you've got collision coverage, take deductibles out of it for our example, and you've got $500 of property damage to your car. Your first party insurer owes you the $500 because you have collision coverage. You get that $500. Do you have to have your car repaired? No. Can you take that money and do with it as you will? Yes. Certainly the law isn't that you actually have to get your car repaired, incur the bill, and then get the $500. No, that's not the law. Now, let's take it to the primary homemaker situation. I'm injured seriously in a car crash. I'm the primary homemaker. I can't scrub my toilets. I can't scoop the dog poop in the backyard. I can't change the kitty litter. I can't turn the mattresses. I can't do the laundry. Those household services have value. And the law, as it currently stands, seeks to compensate that injured homemaker for the value of those household services. No economists would say those don't have value. Of course they do. I dare say no one in this room would tell that homemaker that those services that she or he cannot perform have no value. They do. And when that homemaker cannot perform those household services, a loss has been incurred to that person. A loss has been incurred. An economic detriment has been incurred to that person. What this says, as proposed, is that the only way that person can get compensated for the value of those services as if someone actually performs them. That's not the law. That's not what the law should be. Just like in my car crash scenario, the loss is incurred, that person is entitled to compensation, as the law reads, for the reasonable value of those household services, regardless of whether they're performed or not, because a real loss has been sustained by that person. All right. I wanted to also talk a little bit about what this law on National Women's Day would do to primary homemakers. it would force them, in order to get compensation for the loss of their valuable household chores, to go out and have someone come into their home to do, in my example, the household chores I've listed. That is a loss of freedom. That is a loss of liberty to that household person, that primary homemaker. The law should not require and force that person to invite somebody into their home to do those things. There's no more private property than our homes. None. So I would ask you to consider that idea here as well.
Mr.
I'm
Mercer,
happy to answer any questions, and with that I would conclude my testimony.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, to the testifier's name again?
Mr. Hardin.
I'm sorry, what was it? Mr. Hardin?
Hardin, H-A-R-D-E-N.
Thank you. To the testifier, Mr. Hardin, I'm just curious, hypothetically, in your practice, do you get paid better when there's higher settlements or lower settlements?
Mr. Hardin.
I have a contingent fee agreement like most personal injury lawyers in Minnesota, and the more I collect for a client, for their damages, and to get them fairly compensated, I receive higher compensation.
No further questions.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a really helpful explanation you provided. And I guess it seems like the key phrase to my mind is on 1.12, which is we are talking about people who have a full-time responsibility. And also, so I mean, just to be clear, that's not any exaggeration. We're talking about full-time homemakers, primary homemakers, people who are whose full-time responsibility is caring for the home. And so I guess I appreciate the clarification you provided, because I came into the hearing, I didn't quite understand how this worked, and that was helpful that we're talking about that specific circumstance. Should they then have to pay somebody else, as you said, to come into their home, or do they have the same kind of situation as the ones you described? So anyway, I appreciate that, and I guess that phrase full-time responsibility indicates that's who we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, Mr. Richard Ruhonen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman, thank you, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please thank identify you. Yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Ruhonen. I am an attorney for 20 years doing personal injury law for TSR Injury Law. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I have worked as an attorney for 20 years and served on the Insurance Verification Task Force with you, Mr. Chair, and as well
Mr.
on
Ruhonen,
several...
I was hoping you wouldn't say that, because then people would say, well, how did you mispronounce his name? Sorry, my apologies.
So I'm used to that, but what I wanted to do is talk about the second section of this bill, which is Section 2, Subdivision 1A, and how that applies in practice. First, to talk about Leonardson, I think you have to understand that in Minnesota we have $20,000 in medical expense benefits for no fault. And in this case, Ms. Leonardson purchased additional coverage. She had stacking, so she had $40,000 in benefits, which about 95% of people do not have. So she actually paid extra premiums in this case. She $11,671 was paid by no fault, and $12,000 remained unpaid. Two separate independent fact finders found that State Farm wrongly denied her benefits. The jury in the bodily injury case found that she was owed $12,000 more than paid by State Farm, and although the IME issue and the wrongful denial of benefits is not an issue in that part of the case, they definitely found that those bills should have been paid. And then a no-fault arbitrator, another independent fact finder, found that State Farm also denied those benefits wrongly. So two people, there are two different fact finders found that. And the reason that's important is because the only time a situation can happen is if State Farm, in that case, wrongly denied benefits. And Ms. Leonardson had a contract with State Farm to pay those benefits that were reasonable and necessary, which were found by these two fact finders to be that way. And what happens in reality, I want to kind of talk a little bit about this. Ms. Leonardson and people like her that I represent end up having $12,000 in this case outstanding. So that means someone has to pay for them or they remain outstanding. Many of our clients get sent to collection agencies. They get if they don't don't have health insurance, they have to go to their state-funded health insurance, which means we all pay in the state of Minnesota through medical assistance or through Minnesota Care, ends up paying more. And also, we know that many people nowadays with health insurance have large deductibles, so they might have $5,000 or $10,000. And so these bills all remain outstanding. Some providers are willing to wait to try to get paid pending a no-fault arbitration or a liability claim resolution, but many are not, and so they collect against our clients. So in the end, what we have here is, we have a promise to pay the reasonable and necessary medical expenses, and then the insurance company doesn't do that. They don't live up to their end of the bargain. I am allowed, for instance, to have, I have life insurance, and if I were killed in an automobile crash, I would be allowed to get the tort recovery from the person who was texting or drunk driving and killed me, and my family would be, and I would also be allowed to get my life insurance contract that I contracted for. And that's what this is. This is a contract that's outside the tort side of the case. So the other thing is, one of the most important things is that the No-Fault Act, is its main purpose is to encourage prompt payment of medical bills. And in this case, it actually encourages insurers to say, let's just cut them off and let's see what happens. Maybe the other side will pay for it so we don't have to. But I don't see, unless I missed something, Mr. Chair, I don't see any corresponding reduction in insurance premiums for No-Fault, that because the insurance companies will make a lot more off this. So with that, I think I've covered everything I wanted to cover. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
A couple of questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, how is insurance sold? What kind of a contract is that? Is that a per loss or a value contract?
Mr. Runa.
I'm sorry, a per loss?
Let me rephrase
that. Per claim, you mean?
Is it actual loss or is it a valued contract?
Mr. Runa.
I'm not sure if I quite understand the question, but it's in a no-fault context, it's the actual loss, if that's what you're asking.
Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll.
And then to the question, how is life insurance sold? As an actual loss or as a valued contract?
Okay. Mr. Room.
I'm sorry, I missed the question. I apologize.
Representative O'Driscoll?
When one purchases life insurance, is it on an actual loss or is it on a valued contract?
It's on a value. In that case, it would be on a valued contract.
Mr. Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll.
So what I'm hearing then is we have two different types of insurance that cover an individual for two different claims. One for a valued contract that they purchased on their life to cover expenses, and the second is for their actual loss that they had in an automobile. Am I understanding that correctly?
If you're talking about my example of life insurance, the life insurance example, that would be accurate. But if you're talking, you could put it in a disability context and other insurances as well. So I was just giving one example.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
They were the testifier's examples, and that's why I picked up on those. Since he brought up disability insurance, is that an actual loss or a value contract?
Mr. Room.
It actually depends on the type of disability insurance, because there's numerous types of disability insurance, and some are based on actual loss and some are based on other one. Sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I'm hearing the testifier saying is that people buy different insurance for different needs and different reasons. No need for the testifier to respond. That's just my takeaway from it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto. Sorry. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, exact same question for your area of practice. Is it better financially on a contingency basis for this to pass or to not pass?
Mr. Ruman.
Well, Mr. Chair, it really depends on the situation, because we often have to cut our fees in these kind of cases to pay and take no fee and do it for free, because we have to pay all these different providers and all these bills that haven't been paid. And the other thing you have to understand is my client has to pay a third of anything recovered unless we do that. So they often are left with bills that are outstanding if we don't do that. So sometimes I will collect more. Often we will do it almost on a pro bono basis, because if we can't get the providers to cut their bills, then we have to pay them in full, or our client's left with an outstanding amount, which is problematic for their credit and their ability to pay. So so often we don't even get to that point.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the obfuscation, but my question is it better or worse if this passes or not?
Mr. Ronan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If this passes, it affects very, very few cases that I deal with, because we usually arbitrate our cases beforehand, but not always, because it depends on the circumstances. But yes, in those circumstances, we would possibly make more money depending on the circumstances of the case.
Mr. Runner, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that did provoke a question after all. So as long as my colleague, Representative Crescia, has brought up about incentives, I just would like the other testifier to respond to the point made by this testifier that there's no guarantee that rather than lowering premiums, that this change wouldn't simply increase profits for insurance companies. So if you could respond to that, please.
Ms. Richards or Ms. Richards? Representative Lunan? Whoever wants to answer it.
I'll take that. You're right, Representative. That's a valid point, that there's nothing in this bill that requires that insurance companies lower their premiums when they lower their claims. Typically, insurance companies will do whatever they can to have a competitive price so that they can get market share. So there's an intrinsic one, but nothing direct.
Correct.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And boy, I didn't think the Republican caucus was anti-homemaker here, so, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask for roll call on this bill.
Thank you. Roll call having been requested. Representative Hillstrom, did you have another question other than that?
That's enough, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay. And, Ms. Richard, I apologize. Did you want to answer as well when Representative Lunan spoke just a minute ago, or did he cover it?
He covered it, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I think we're up to Mr. Carlson. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Always appreciate brevity and its different interpretations. Mr. Carlson, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, Mr. Hardin and Mr. Brunan answered many of the questions, but we really worry both that we take away the benefit of homemakers, which is problematic, and that is a value, Representative Driscoll, that's a value. It's not a loss. It's a value, and it's capped at $200 a week, and we're eliminating that. But the biggest concern I have on Section 2, and I really think we need to think about the incentives here. No fault under 65B is intended to promote prompt payment. And if you change that incentive where you can tell, you can deny benefits, and that happens over 7,000 times a year in Minnesota. That's how many no-fault arbitrations we have. If you change that incentive where they can deny and just see what happens, and I never have to come back and pay on my contract benefits that I paid for, that I am not going to be able to collect because you denied. That's exactly what happened in this case, Leonardson. They denied her benefits. She had to go to district court to collect her damages, and she went back and then collected what was wrongly denied up to the value of her policy. So these policies are $20,000 of wage loss, $20,000 of medical. So there's a value, and there's a set amount. It's not unlimited. It's a set amount. So, Mr. Chairman, we really think that this one needs more work, because you're changing the fundamental principle of no-fault prompt payment and to provide offsets for recoveries. It's not to prevent double recoveries. If you read the statute, it says it's to provide offsets to avoid duplicative recoveries. These were not duplicative. I recovered in tort, and I recovered my contract damages that I was entitled to, that I paid my own insurance premium for. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Crescia.
Just to the female testifier, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. How do you respond to this as a bill against homemakers and a war on women?
Ms. Richards.
There are two parts to replacement services claims. If you are not considered a primary homemaker, you are required to actually incur the expenses. The primary homemaker, to be clear, does not mean that you are a primary homemaker. Means you have greater responsibility for the home than anyone else in your home. Does not mean that you are a homemaker and do not have another full-time job. A person can establish that they are the primary homemaker simply by testifying, I do most of the work around the house. So what it requires, as Mr. Lunan pointed out, is that there is a loss, that something be replaced, that these things simply don't go undone.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Representative Pinto.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I guess that confuses me, though, because the provision we're talking about only applies when the injured person has the full-time responsibility. That is their full-time responsibility. So it seems like even if a primary homemaker means something broader, we're talking about a primary full-time homemaker, somebody whose full-time responsibility is to provide the care and maintenance of a home. So I guess it seems like that is pretty narrowly focused in that way, unless I'm misunderstanding.
Representative Pinto is a fairly clever non-attorney. Thought that'd be funnier. I'll take a crack at it. I think, as Ms. Richard said, it does say full-time responsibility, but it doesn't necessarily say that they can't have an outside job or something else that they do.
Mr. Chair, I understand that might be the argument, but it'd be interesting bringing that up in court to argue somebody was, usually if it's a full-time responsibility, it means a full-time responsibility. I'm not quite sure how you argue your way around that one, but maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
Well, Representative Pinto, I've done a pretty good job so far of avoiding court under, if we ever have a delay, I'll tell you the story, but so far, been pretty good. Ms. Richards?
I say, Your Honor, Mr. Chair, I, for example,
I've been elevated, Mr. Chair.
I do look good in a robe, but.
Hopefully it clarifies.
The judge's role.
I'm a full-time attorney. I am also a single mom. I am considered under the No Fault Act. I have full-time responsibility as a homemaker in my home.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess maybe this question to Mr. Carlson or one of the other testifiers then, if that's correct, then so it sounds like what's being asserted is that this provision would apply then to you, despite having, and it sounds like there's some nodding from Mr. Carlson, so I guess I had misunderstood that, so my apologies if there's a comment that Mr. Carlson has.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, that you're just focusing in on what the issue here is. There are separate and distinct replacement services, and there's the homemaker benefit. You can't collect both of them, but the value of your services to your family and your house has a value. And whether you hire Mary Maids, then you get that. If you don't, you're still entitled to collect the value of the loss of your service to your household. That's what we're eliminating here. And yes, it is principally a benefit for women. But that's what we're eliminating, just so we're clear. There's three ways to collect. We're eliminating the middle one, which is the primary homemaker benefit, which they want you to go and get a maid or somebody to do the work. And that has not been the case at least since 1985.
Thank you. Ms. Richards.
And even under the statute, there's still no requirement. It's not creating a requirement that those services be paid. It's simply creating the requirement that the services be done. It has, since Rendall, 1985, it has been the case that if, say, a significant other or a family member comes in and does those services, there's no requirement. There's still no loss. Economic loss doesn't have to be incurred. They just have to be replaced.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak on this bill, for or against? Not seeing anybody. No further questions. Representative Lunan, we'll give you the final word.
Mr. Chairman, members, this bill simply says that insurance owes for a loss you actually incur. The comment was made that if you pay your deductible, you don't have to, for your claim, you don't have to fix your car. That's actual cash value type loss settlement. You do not collect replacement costs on your home unless you actually replace. That's how replacement cost works. And to the second point, the no-fault statute was designed to create a healthy environment for people to seek medical treatment and get care at home that's going to aid in their recovery. And if they don't seek that out, whether they pay for it or not, as the testifier said, the insurance company shouldn't be paying anything out and then passing those costs on to other insurers. I appreciate a green vote.
With that, Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 1012 be re-referred to the General Register. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative Fenton.
Aye.
Representative Anderson. Representative Applebaum.
No.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
Green.
Representative Franzen. Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kresha?
Aye.
Representative Loon?
Aye.
Representative Lunan?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Rosenthal?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Swiedzinski?
Aye.
By a vote of 11 to 6, the motion does prevail. Thank you, members, for a good discussion. Thank you to all the testifiers. And we are on to Representative Halverson. House File 1401. Representative Halverson, Representative Halverson moves House File 1401 for possible inclusion in a further omnibus, whatever we're calling it, reform bill. Thank you for that, Representative Halverson, and with that, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for spending some time talking about reinsurance. I bring this forward in the spirit of the search for really good ideas to help our individual insurance market. Representative Davids is carrying House File 5 and has presented on that. I am a co-author in that bill. Representative Davids is a co-author of mine. I think that the message here is that no one has yet found the panacea to fix the healthcare individual healthcare marketplace. But I will tell you a couple values that I bring to this discussion. My goal is to help stabilize the individual market, to bring back those young, healthy people that have exited the market. My goal is to drive down premiums, supporting our consumers. And my goal is also to start shifting our priority. We've spent a lot of time in crisis mode in terms of how we're paying for health care. And during that time, we're seeing costs continue to rise. And I really want to take the resources that we are using in the state to not just help pay for health care, but also help get to the underlying costs, the reason that our premiums are so expensive. Minnesota's and the individual market have benefited since about 1976 from artificial manipulation of the market by the state. We did that in Minnesota through a successful high-risk pool. MSHA no longer exists. And what we see now without federal reinsurance is the actual impact of the cost of health care on premiums in the individual market. Minnesota has a very small individual market for a state of our size, in large part because we have great employers who have committed to providing health care benefits for their employees. The current high premiums are really our first look at the unfettered marketplace of the individual market. And this is going to be the most volatile and the most expensive part of the market, and that's why Minnesota historically has always worked to help drive down costs in the individual market. We want to be sure that people can go out on their own, hang out their own shingle, and be innovative and entrepreneurial, or maybe retire early, and they're going to need options to make sure that they have health care coverage. The kinds of premiums that are the result of this kind of unfettered, unmanipulated market are driving the youngest, healthiest people out of the marketplace. They're vital to the balance of the marketplace. So we're trying to solve a really big math problem together. And so that's why I bring forward 1404, which has a lot of, I think, similar approaches to what Representative Davids is trying to do, including reestablishing a board to deal with this, similar to the MSHA board, to manage reinsurance for the state of Minnesota, as well as making sure that we are taking a look at how to manage costs. In the middle, the approach is, how do we reinsure? We can reinsure through an attachment point and share risk with an insurer generally. My approach is actually to reinsure, to share risk with it, insurers based on certain illness and disease categories kind of like a virtual high-risk pool, if you will. The costs in those pools tend to be predictable for people with chronic illnesses and could be very helpful in helping insurance companies plan for what their insurance needs are going to be. Basically, when those rates get set and when insurers go to the Commerce Department to set rates, they're setting their predictions. What is the impact going to be on the market in the next several years, and how is that going to impact premiums? And are we going to bring in enough premium to pay for the health care costs? And sometimes that guess is right. Sometimes that guess is wrong. And we know in the past couple of years that guess has been wrong. We have not, premiums have not kept pace with the cost of care. And that's why we are out of balance. So, my approach is to reinsure based on risk of individuals who have certain illnesses, much like the Alaska model does, as well as to encourage care management. We also know that 30% of all the dollars that are spent in our healthcare system are waste. Most of that waste actually comes from lack of care coordination and out of whack pricing within the healthcare system. Prescription drugs is a really good example. Now, that being insulin dependent, I can tell you that insulin is not affordable for people without insurance, and that's a drug that keeps people alive on a day-to-day basis. So we want to be sure that we are doing more to drive down costs within the system. And to that end, the payment mechanism that is in here is through the Healthcare Access Fund, the goal of which is to extend health care to more Minnesotans, through the provider tax specifically. That is the broadest tax within the healthcare system. Other taxes that are levied in the healthcare system do not actually tax people who are in the self-insured market, and that is most of Minnesota. And so we want to be able to use the broadest tax possible and not put more tax pressure on small businesses or individuals. And then to that end, there is the opportunity for reinsurance payments to be part of some care coordination models so that providers could earn back a portion of what they pay into the premium. And that moving forward, we would ask that MSHA board that we would remodel to be the reinsurance board to take a look at what the cost drivers are in the system from year to year as we decide how to share risk with our insurers in Minnesota, addressing what is driving the cost in the system. And that is as brief an overview as I could do on reinsurance, Mr. Chair. And I hope to hear from a lot of other people about this.
Representative Halverson, so do we, and I should know this and I apologize for not, do we need to get a federal waiver for this bill?
Mr. Chair, I put a request for a federal waiver in this bill. However, it is not dependent on the waiver. The waiver would definitely provide us some protection in our BHP, but it's not dependent, so we could move forward.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Roll call.
No. Representative Halverson, the governor has a proposal to allow folks to buy into Minnesota Care. Mm-hmm. How do you believe your bill would impact that proposal if people wanted to go in that direction?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I actually think that based on what the governor's office has put forward with the buy-in plan, these ideas could hang together. The governor is proposing to allow buy-ins for gold and silver plans in the public marketplace, which essentially would attract people who need to use more health care. Those plans are more expensive, and they have better coverage for people who probably have a chronic illness or people who are going to use more cost in the system. And again, it's targeting those people who are less healthy and getting them into a program where we can manage their costs better, and allowing that individual market to be more wide open for those young, healthy people. If we drive down costs in that individual market by getting sicker people out of it or sicker people better insured, we have more room in the marketplace for those costs to get driven down, the premium costs, so that it'll attract young, healthy people. And you can see the impact that that's had historically in Minnesota with the way that we have lost members in the individual market in the last 2 years. When our rates were artificially low in 2014, we saw the highest participation in the individual insurance market in years. But when reinsurance went away at the federal level, when our high risk pool went away, all of those essentially market pressures were just taken off the individual market, and premiums skyrocketed. So it would help rebalance the marketplace. That is my super long nerdy answer. I'm sorry. I hope it made sense.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Halverson, for the people who don't understand at home, if anybody's listening, probably not.
Riveted.
There are many ways that you can format reinsurance. One way is the state kind of sets aside the pot of money, right? And then if you have a billable claim, you kind of bill it to the pool, and they get reimbursed. There are incidences where the pool is not completely used, and my question is that your model? And then if all of the pool of money is not used, who gets it? Does the insurance company get it, or does the general fund get it, or what happens to the reinsurance pool of money that has been set aside for claims to be made?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, it stays part of the Healthcare Access Fund. And so everybody, because the Healthcare Access Fund is dedicated revenue dollars from our healthcare system to increase access to affordable healthcare, it would go to, it would be there for other supports within the system, essentially in the healthcare system.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Ms. Kmit, do you want to come up and share your wisdom with us? Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some comment on House File 1401. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Representative Halverson for bringing forward this proposal. It's a little bit different than the House File 5 that we've been talking about with Representative Davids. This proposal adheres more closely to the Alaska model. And just to give people a little perspective of what happened in Alaska, of course, it's they have a smaller population than the state of Minnesota, but in particular, their individual market is only about 22,000 people. When you compare that to the latest numbers of our individual market of about 190,000 people, it's quite a remarkable difference. They also only had one carrier. Here we have about five carriers that would be involved. There they had, they appropriated $55 million to this reinsurance account from the state legislature, and it really accrues back to only about 400 people who qualify. That, I just did the math, it turns out that equals to $137,500 per individual. So these are very expensive situations, people who have very expensive health care costs and needs. I think this proposal that Representative Halverson has brought forward has some interesting ideas, and I think they're worth exploring. My major concern is that we need to have a reinsurance program set up and in place by the end of March, because as I've mentioned before, the health plans are in the process of developing their rates and their products for 2018, and they need the assurances knowing that there is going to be this risk mitigation program in place so that they can move forward with their products. I think this, having said that, I think that this is something that the reinsurance board that gets created should be looking at. And what I like about House File 5 is that it sets up this bridge to 2018. I think that there should be a way to encourage alternative ideas and innovative thinking about ways to address this issue as we go forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Is there anyone else that wants to speak on the bill, for or against? Mr. Commissioner. Commissioner Rothman, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. And members, thank you for the opportunity to talk today a little bit about this and this proposal. I don't want to go over some of the major points. We need to do something to stabilize, make the rates more affordable as soon as possible. I do want to emphasize a few things. One is that we need to do it quickly and hopefully through legislation and adopt it by April 1st, hopefully. If we can get to that place, that would be terrific. It would lend certainty to what we're doing going forward. I do want to emphasize a few things. Again, the goal and objectives of what we're taking a look at are affordability of premiums, market stability, and network access. With respect to reinsurance, we achieve results with affordable premiums, market stability. Network access becomes difficult with respect to reinsurance, but at the same time, we want to look at, I encourage members of the committee to look at all of the options that are put out on the table, including the governor's proposal on Minnesota Care buy-in, how that works, how that achieves better access for everybody. But also how these proposals work with respect to bringing down rates and affordability and all of that. Again, there are a variety of options being put forward. There are pros and cons, and as I wanted to talk specifically about the pros and cons of this reinsurance proposal in front of you compared to the others that we have seen, the one in the, that's running on the Senate side, the House File 5, and draw out some of those. First of all, I did mention, and I have testified, that the Alaska model is one that the department has looked at very carefully. It is in the process of being approved and going through the process with CMS, the Department of Human Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C. Importantly to that, this is familiar to them in the sense of achieving and accomplishing something for the 2018 marketplace. This proposal, let me just highlight a few things. It targets specific high-cost chronic medical conditions for reinsurance, as you've seen. An advantage of the approach is that more reinsurance funding goes directly to premium relief for consumers because the chronic conditions have more predictable costs for insurers and can be more accurately accounted for in their rate filings. It also, as you've seen, it also has better opportunities or offers opportunities for insurers and providers to work together on case management and cost containment for the high cost claims, the ones that are putting the pressure on rates and all that and causing the instability. Time is of the essence, and let me just say that with respect to this proposal, it's important for the legislature for us to pass and put something in place by April 1st, meaning we would have the certainty of something being passed, the plans would be able to develop that. And then in terms of implementation, the department, the timeline for implementation is the entire year, meaning the proposal has to be, the board has to be up and running, operations up and running, we have to have the plan in place. By the end of the year, there is time, I should say this, there is time to pass this legislation and then to have the implementation of it up and running in time to have it in place for the 2018 program, meaning everything can be set up in terms of operations and all of that. With respect to the comparisons between 1401, between House File 5 and Senate File 720, there are pros and cons to each of those proposals. When viewing each of them through the lens of stabilizing the individual marketplace, encouraging participation by consumers and health carriers, eliminating unintended consequences to the Minnesota Care and Federal Tax Credits, and finding sustainability for all of us to maximize the positive impact of the funding on the marketplace. There are differences among the proposals. This proposal has some advantages I want to point out. One is that we are able to achieve, based on our analysis, a lower per member per month dollar figure than the other two proposals. That means we can get the rates down to the consumers with this proposal a little better. We also could probably get to a higher amount of reduction, rate reduction, than the other two proposals, at least by, in comparison to the Senate file, by an additional 2 to 3 percentage points, but in comparison to House file 5, a significant amount. The proposals are approximately the same. This one, again, we would need about, we're looking at a dollar figure of approximately the same with respect to each of these proposals. And then the amount of federal and state share is about the same, two-thirds, one-third, between all the programs. So there's really not much of a difference there. With respect to the 1332 waiver, there's time it's allowed to do that, and it's necessary to make sure that we don't have a negative impact on the BHP nor on the APTC. I did indicate this earlier, that the federal agency is familiar with the Alaska model and then would be familiar with the process that it's using for the 1332 waiver for the approval of Alaska. And that would roughly be the same for each of the programs, each of the reinsurance proposals. We've already been working with CMS to allow us to basically, as I said before, catch the football, whatever the legislature provides and passes, to get that submitted to the federal government. I did mention that this proposal allows us to get more reinsurance money directly to the premium relief, to the chronic conditions. And then there's been the testimony that Section 9 does contain additional care coordination and provider cost containment that has the additional benefit of this reinsurance proposal compared to the others. And then finally, I'd say, again, most importantly, we need something passed. Once we have something passed that creates certainty for the insurers and what the marketplace will do, and that with respect to this and the others, we have the entire year to stand it up, meaning we just have to have it in place and operationalized by the end of this year so that the reinsurance payments can be made in 2018 for the 2018 marketplace. So with that, I'm open for questions, members.
Thank you, Commissioner Rothman. Representative, not seeing any questions. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And we have one last testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Kristen Longcourt with the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing 142 hospitals and health systems across the state. MHA is very supportive of the goal of trying to stabilize the individual insurance market, but we are very concerned that House File 1401 relies solely on use of the Health Care Access Fund. Our organization is appreciative of the balanced approach that we're seeing in House File 5, authored by Representative Davids, with that current language. You know, we're very concerned with the pending repeal of the Affordable Care Act at the federal level. There's just enormous uncertainty about how much federal money is going to be available, and we continue to believe that the Health Care Access Fund needs to be reserved for its intended purpose of coverage for very low-income Minnesotans. So we urge lawmakers to continue to work on a shared approach to funding the reinsurance program. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Not seeing any member questions. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak on this bill? For or against? Seeing none, Representative Halverson will give you the final word.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for spending some time this afternoon talking more about reinsurance. There are very few rooms where this can be talked about with any sense of understanding. So thank you to everybody sitting around the table and sitting in the audience. And again, I just want to underscore that this has been something that Minnesota has participated in. Working to help stabilize the individual market is something that our state has invested in for years. And so it's not a new action. I think that the goal and the sense of urgency is a little bit different, but I think that it is a role that we need to take really seriously, and I thank everybody who's putting their heads together to solve this problem. So,
Representative Halverson, I appreciate working with you and your willingness to dive into this subject, not just on this bill, but all session. And with that, House File 1401 is laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Kreshaw.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chair. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 68.
And I believe you have a DE1 amendment?
I do have the DE1 amendment, and I believe that this is moving, the motion should be to move it to the general register.
That is correct. And as customary to the committee, we always take the author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will do that, and because it is essentially going to be the this year's omnibus liquor bill, why don't we adopt that? I'll go through it, and then we have a celebrity testifier that wants to come down and talk about one specific provision of this bill that is new to the committee, new today. So, Mr. Chair, I will move the DE1 amendment.
Thank you. And members, let's get this bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Okay. Motion prevails. And with that, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will quickly go through the sections of the bill, and then we'll have our testifier here talk about his specific provision, the part that's new to the bill. Running through this quickly, because I think everybody has a pretty good idea what's in it, Section 1 is essentially what we're trying to do here. Since we passed the cocktail room laws a few years ago, we want to make sure that if somebody's operating a cocktail room in Minnesota, that they're doing it with Minnesota, that it's actually a Minnesota-made product. And this language that we have in here, I've had a number of people contact me, and we're going to have a testifier on this. This language isn't the final product, but I think with Mr. McCormick's help and with everybody taking a look at it, we can get to a point where we can have language in there that I think reflects what we're trying to do and what we were originally looking at in terms of sort of protecting the consumers of Minnesota. Section 2 is the Sundays, allowing cocktail rooms to be open on Sundays. Section 3 is a technical section of the bill that was brought to us by DPS. It just makes it really clear that DPS is actually the one that that is in charge of the cocktail rooms. Section 4, 5, and 6 are where we start getting into the changes in the numbers. And Section 4 is brew pubs, which is currently the off-sale sales may not total more than 500. We move that to 750. Section 5 was the small brewer off-sale. We're taking that number from 20,000 to 40,000. Section 6, we're trying to specify. We're not trying. We're specifying what size growlers can be. And we're saying anything between 650 milliliters and 2 liters to accommodate any whatever breweries want to do with any kind of special shape or commemorative design. Section 7 is actually the start of this bill. It's 3-2 labeling, so that instead of having it have to be on the top of the can, it could also be on the side of the can or the bottle. Section 8, I think we're getting back to the distillation and kind of what I talked about with the first section in terms of making sure that products that are in cocktail rooms are actually Minnesota made. When we get to Section 9 and going on, we're starting to talk about a lot of the special licenses. And Section 9, the first one that we come to is where in the bill? I think that was for the 43 Upton restaurant. which I don't remember whose provision that was, but I will find out. Section 10 is service at the Capitol and Capitol grounds, allowing them to expand and have wine and malt liquor sold on the Capitol and Capitol grounds. And this is with the approval of the Department of Administration and the City of St. Paul. Section 11, kind of the same thing, special events license at the Capitol. Again, if the City of St. Paul approves, and I think specifically this would be for the Super Bowl that's coming here in January and the associated World's Giantest Ice Palace that's going to be here.
And Chair Hoppe, one second. I believe we have the A4 amendment that we have to do first.
Okay, so we need to do the A4 amendment to the D1. Okay, well, then let me run through the last couple. Section 12 was represent a bar's bill for the training site for the Vikings. Section 13 is a special license for the New Hope Golf Course. 14 was Representative Driscoll's that we heard today for the City of Sartell. Section 15 is, I think it was Representative Dean's for the closing times for the Super Bowl. And Section 16 is a moratorium. My idea for putting the moratorium in is I have had a number of members, including Senate members, but House members, primarily Democrats and Republicans, come to me and express a desire to not have to hear different changes for the brew pubs and growlers and everything every year. And this was just an effort to try to get that to finally get to something where there's closure, where everybody agrees this is where the limits are going to be, and we can all stick to that. And Section 17 was a repealer. And with that, we should probably go to the A4 amendment.
And thank you. And Chair Hoppe moves the author's amendment, A4 amendment. And Chair Hoppe, would you like to explain that amendment to the Section 17?
Mr. Chair, I assume that the A4 amendment is the section that we want. Nope. Mr. McCormick, I apologize. I've got the A4 amendment. I just don't remember which section
McCormick?
That is.
Madam Chair, members, the...
Was that the repealer from the 2001?
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the repealer in the bill is improperly coded, so this replaces it with the properly coded repealer. It repeals the existing law on service of capital, service of alcohol at the Capitol, and which is replaced by the new law in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick. With that, Mr. Chair, I would move the A4 amendment.
With that, Chair Hoppe moves the A4 amendment. Any questions, discussion of the A4 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The A4 carries. And to that, rest of the I'd like to move the A1 amendment for Representative Jessup. And so Representative Crescia moves the A1 amendment. Representative Jessup to the A1 amendment.
Chair Crescia.
That sounds so nice.
Members of this esteemed committee, I am here representing the Twin Cities Marathon. And they have a desire to serve some alcoholic beverages at the finish line to their VIP guests in a VIP tent. And particularly they want to serve some hard liquor and champagne and wine. They have done so with, I think, malt liquor and beer in the past. And so this is really a revision simply to allow them greater flexibility on the alcoholic beverages that they will serve to their guests. And since we have the responsibility of alcohol on the state capitol grounds, this is in our purview.
Any questions, members, for Representative Jessup? Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jessup and members, I assume that this would be done with the in conjunction with the approval of the City of St. Paul.
Representative Jessup.
Thank you for the question. Yes, Chair and Representative Hoppe, the City of St. Paul has said that they are fine with us proceeding with this action.
Thank you. And anyone want to testify for or against the A1 amendment? Seeing none. Members, any questions? With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Jessup. And with that, I believe we're going to move on to the A6. Is that yours, Representative Lynn?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What this does is...
Representative Luna moves the A6 amendment. Representative Hilster, I'm sorry, you have a question?
Oh, so Mr. Chair, I can wait until after those amendments are done. I have a question for the author about one of the sections.
Okay. let's do it after the amendment. Is that okay? Thank you. Representative Lunan moves the A6 amendment. Two-year amendment. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the A6 amendment does is on line 22 of page 2, strike the 375 milliliter bottle per customer day limit.
Okay.
And the word and. And on line 27, strike the period and insert the colon and. And then on 1.7, no more than 8,000 proof gallons of the 40,000 proof gallons produced by a distiller can be sold at off-site on-premise.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Chair Hoppe, any comments?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lunan, for years when we've been looking at the omnibus liquor bill, I'm kind of somebody who will put anything in there, anything that we can get the votes for that we can pass. I didn't include this language in there because I didn't get a sense from the committee members that there was a lot of support for it. But if it's in there, you know, whatever we come out of this committee with, whatever we take to hopefully a conference committee with the Senate, if this is the will of the committee, I'll fight for it in committee. So I will leave it up to the chair and the members on how they want to vote on this one.
Thank you. Representative Lunan, could you go through your amendment one more time for Representative Hillstrom? She has a question.
On page 2, line 22, we're going to strike the term of one 375 milliliter bottle per customer day, which can be sold. On line 25, we're going to strike the word and in that sentence. On page 2, on line 27, strike the period. It's just a clerical. Strike the period and insert a colon and the word and. On page 2, on line 27 also, we're going to insert no more than 8,000 proof gallons of 40,000 proof gallons produced by a distiller can be sold at off sale on the premises.
And I'm going to come back to member questions in a second, so if you have further questions, we'll come back to it. Anybody testifying for or against the A6? Mr. Montana, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Chris Montana. I am the co-owner, along with my wife, of Du Nord Craft Spirits, which is a micro distillery in Minneapolis. I've had the pleasure of meeting with many of you, and if you haven't met with me, you may have met with some of my colleagues or other distillers from around the state. We've met with you looking for some parity in the law between the wine producers, the beer producers, and us, the spirit producers. Just a little bit about who we are. We're a grain-to-glass distillery. We make everything from scratch, from corn from my wife's farm in Cold Spring, Minnesota.
And Mr. Montana, I'm going to ask you to be brief. We do have to hit the 4:45, and I think we're all well aware of your background, so thank you.
I'll take that as a good thing.
It is a good thing. I'm keeping us moving. Trust me, just keep us moving.
Outstanding. As this committee very well knows, if I own a winery, I can sell all the wine that I want out of my back door. If I own a brewery, I can sell up to a certain limit of beer, but no particular limit on any individual purchaser. What we're seeking to do here is the exact same thing. We have seen a great deal of support from the members of this committee, and we hope that that support will be reflected today. Our ask is a qualified ask. It's different than it was before. We've put a limit on it. Before, we were simply asking for the ability to sell, much like the wineries do. We have changed that, and we are now saying we're happy to take a limit on that that is analogous to the limit that the breweries have. Our ultimate hope here is to build our brands. That's all. We have the unenviable position of coming before you, and our opposition is our customers, but we want to see those customers stay in business, and we hope to work with them for a long, long time. But we also need to build our brands, and to the extent that you have any questions about how we arrived at this number, or what this might do for our industry. I'm happy to take those questions.
And thank you, Mr. Montana. May I have you hold for 1 second? Representative Hilson, do you have a question to the testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to how many 16-ounce glasses would this be, or how many drinks would this be the equivalent of?
And is that to the testifier?
Whoever can answer.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, how many 16-ounce glasses? I would have to pull out the calculator and try to break apart the proof gallonage. The way that we arrived at this number is what's currently proposed in the bill before you for the brewers is a limit of 750 barrels. 750 barrels of beer is equal to 24,000 gallons of beer. What we've done with that number is we've said, well, our products are typically around 5 times more alcoholic than that, and so we'll cut their number by 5, divided by 5, and then use that as a number for us. That gets us a little bit lower than the 8,000 that we're looking for, but as I've heard Chair Hoppe say, we are an aspirational people, and we'd love to hit that mark.
Representative Hilstrom, follow up?
I'll wait till the other testifier.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. This is really the component of the bill that I had brought before us before, but it has been scaled down. The distillers are great folks. Many of us have distillers in our districts or businesses that support them, and as the testifier said, we're just trying to achieve parity, and I would appreciate your green vote.
And with that, any other further questions? Any other testifiers for or against the A6 amendment? Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Joel Carlson. I represent the Minnesota Wine and Spirit Wholesale Association, and as we did testify when Representative Nash's bill was before the committee, it was just 2015 when we allowed these distillers to breach the three-tier system to sell their product on site. Now we're expanding that, and not just by a little, by 8,000 gallons. We are making these now retail liquor stores on site for up to 8,000 gallons of product, and that's a pretty big expansion, and we just would reiterate that we support the three-tier system for a reason. It's because it works, and these are just further erosions of that, and we have concerns about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions for Mr. Carlson? Seeing none. Any other testifiers for or against the amendment? Seeing none. Representative Hilstrom, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask for a roll call.
Roll call being requested. Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, I was visited by people on behalf of the distillers, and this Lunin Amendment changes it. I would support the bill in its current form, but now I think it's going a little too far.
Roll call being requested.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
And I would say I ordinarily would be the first one to vote, and because I don't want to be the one that decides this. We'll let the committee decide. I'm going to pass for my first vote, and then
very good.
We'll let the committee decide.
Thank you. With that, take the roll call.
Chair Hoppe.
Pass.
Representative Fenton.
Pass.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Applebaum.
No.
Representative Barr.
Yes.
Representative Davids. Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hilstrom.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Loon.
Aye.
Representative Loonen.
Yes.
Representative Nash.
Yes.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
We're left no.
That was a no?
I'm sorry, what was that? No?
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Skudzinski. Representative Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative Fenton.
Aye.
On a vote of 9-7, the motion prevails. With that, we'll move on to the A5 amendment. And I believe that is Representative Lunin as well.
Members, the A5.
Representative Lunin, would you like to withdraw your amendment?
Yeah, I would like to withdraw that.
Representative Lunin withdraws his amendment. Moving to the A6, and I believe that's Representative. We just did the A6 as well.
Yeah.
Wrong bill? So we're on the bill?
We're
with the goals.
We're at the bill.
All right. We are back to the bill as amended. And 1 second. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to do an amendment on page 10, section 16. I'd like to delete section 16.
Representative Anderson moves to amend section 16.
Delete section 16.
Delete section 16. Representative Hoppe?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I would accept that as a friendly amendment.
Representative Hoppe accepts that as a friendly amendment. Members, any questions? Anyone wish to testify for or against the friendly amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We are back to the bill as amended. Chair Hoppe, and I'd like to request a roll call. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually have two different oral amendments. The first oral amendment that I would like to offer, this passes. I won't offer the second one. On line 3.23, I'd like to reinstate the stricken language. So delete the new language of 40,000 barrels and reinstate the 20,000 barrels.
Representative Hillstrom asks, motions for an oral amendment on line 3.23 that reinserts the stricken language. Ms. McCormick, you had that. Okay. Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, unlike the last amendment, I would, as much as I like Representative Hillstrom, and I really do, I would regard this as an unfriendly amendment and would encourage a no vote.
And Representative Anderson, did you have a question? No question? Okay. Anyone wish to testify for or against? Mr. Bagnoli, welcome to the committee. I won't remind you we're at 11 minutes. And I'm sorry, I don't have the other name, so if you could state your name for the record. Mr. Bagnoli, take your name for the record.
Mr. Again. Chair, I'm Joe Bagnoli, representing the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. This is
I'm Jennifer Schoenzeit. I own Zips Liquor Store in Minneapolis, and I'm also the president of the Minnesota Liquor and Beverage Association.
And I'm sorry, could you say your last name one more time?
Schoenzeit.
Schoenzeit, Ms. Schoenzeit. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm here to testify against this. There's three parts to this. They're asking to raise the barrel limit again. And it's just, we got to come up with a number. And the second part, the 500 milliliters to seven, the different growler sizes, that's a 22-ounce can. I sell a gazillion 24-ounce cans. If the breweries can start selling 50-milliliter growlers, the purpose of the growler law was to sell things that we don't. If they want to be retail, open a liquor store, you know. It's becoming very confusing, the amount that they're asking to sell out their front door to their customers. That's what I do. I'm having trouble getting product because they're selling so much through their back rooms and through growlers. Their products aren't even getting to my store. I mean, they're not even really true breweries. They're almost brew pubs because they're not getting to the public. They're just selling through their own. You know, the laws are fine the way they are. They're working. It's just every year they're here. Our store has been there 61 years. We've never been here asking for a law change. You know, it's like my father started the store. We learned to play in the rules. We knew what the pool looked like when we started our business. You know, that is what I have.
Mr. Bagnoli?
Mr. Chair, Joe Bagnoli again on behalf of the MLBA. I would just point out that 4 years ago we had an agreement with the Brewers Guild to raise the limit from 3,500 barrels to 20,000 barrels, under which you could do it. We did that actually on the basis of we didn't pick 20,000 barrels out of a hat because they had a legitimate. We felt at the time they said at 3,500 barrels, the minute we go to 3,501 barrels, we lose a lot of revenue, and we need that revenue to help expand. We said that's a legitimate argument. Where is the point where you become a big brewery and these little exceptions to the three-tier system become exceptions that you don't no longer need to expand? We talked to other breweries in Minnesota that have been through this, and they told us that at roughly 18,000 barrels, is when you become, when you basically need to do, use a wholesaler. You're so big that you become, becomes necessary to the whole, to use a wholesaler. So the wholesaling limit used to be 25,000 barrels. I'll go quick.
And I'm going to, I'm going to ask you to get right to the oil amendment.
We moved it, we moved that down to 20,000 barrels. So the number was picked with a reason, with a rationale. 40,000 barrels is picked with, there is no rationale under 40,000 barrels other than it's double the amount that we're currently at. It's a, there's, it's roughly 26,000 cases more of beer, 20,000 is. And we would just urge you that this essentially helps what, there are currently five breweries out of 138 breweries in Minnesota that are over 20,000. Two are at 150 or so, one is at 80, one is at about probably 60, and there's one at 27. This will help one brewery in Minnesota.
And thank you, Ms. Schoenzeit. Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Hang on 1 second. I see a couple other testifiers. Representative Halverson, you have a question?
I can wait.
You can wait. Thank you. To the two testifiers, it looks like Mr. Irwin and Mr. Fulton. If you want to come down and speak very quickly to the 20,000, 40,000 oil amendment, please do so. Welcome.
Good morning.
Mr. Irwin, is that correct?
Yes.
And Mr. Fulton, you're on deck. Mr. Irwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House Committee. My name is Brant Irwin. I'm an attorney. I represent the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association. We're the family-owned distributors that employ thousands of Minnesotans throughout the state. I'll keep my testimony very, very brief. I know that you're trying to push
this right to the oral amendment.
We support the oral amendment to retain the 20,000 instead of expanding to 40,000. 40,000 barrels is over 500,000 cases. It's 520,000 cases of beer. So what this would do is this would expand the regulatory exemptions that are afforded right now to brewers that aren't afforded to other members of the industry. Really, you know, I'll just kind of mirror what Mr. Bagnoli said. This expansion is seemingly, to us, it's a solution looking for a problem. Prior testimony reflects that really only one brewery will be served by any expanded capacity. It's Fulton. They have a business model, from what I understand from prior testimony, that is based in part upon growler sales, and right now they've surpassed the 20,000 production limit. So what we would do is we would suggest that you support the oral amendment because the bill, as it is proposed to increase from 20,000 to 40,000, significantly alters the regulatory system as it stands.
And thank you for being concise. Mr.
Thank
Fulton.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I need to restate my name. My name is actually Ryan Petz of the Fulton
name.
Brewery, although Mr. Fulton has a very nice ring to it. So I'll take it. I'm here to testify in opposition to the oral amendment and in support of the previous version. To clarify, the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild, of which I'm also representing here, and our stance on this bill, the bill as we originally proposed it was to increase the production threshold from 20,000 barrels to 250,000 barrels. That number was not arbitrary. That was chosen to match the amount of barrelage that a brewery could also have a tap room, the on-premise side, with. So we were just putting forth an attempt to match the off-sale with the on-sale. The 40,000 in the amendment would be a step forward for our group. Currently, the only brewery that would benefit from that today would be Fulton. But I do want to restate that our original attempt was to be inclusive of all breweries in Minnesota. The further beneficiaries of the increase from 20,000 barrels to 40,000 barrels would in future years, I think, include some of the other breweries that have grown rapidly and healthily in Minnesota, including Indeed Brewing, Bent Paddle Brewing, Liftbridge. So there's a number of others who might not make a difference to in 2017, but maybe next year or the year after. The 20,000 barrel number is also, for some of our memberships, members, not Fulton particularly, representative of several kind of converging events, being the expiration of the self-distribution benefits that small breweries like Indeed, for example, enjoy, as well as the point where breweries now need to start paying in-state excise tax to the state of Minnesota. So there's kind of a converging series of events that at that 20,000 barrel level hits breweries all at the same time. By raising the growler threshold to 40,000 barrels, it would at least remove one of those three converging issues.
Thank you, Mr. Pence. I apologize about the name. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say I'm really concerned about the fact that we are pitting small businesses against small businesses in this committee. I think that the fact that we are hearing from multi-generationally owned small retail establishments that they're concerned about being able to continue to operate if we make this change and continue to make this change. It's like we just keep pushing and pushing and pushing the boundaries. I think, and I would respectfully ask the author of this bill and others on the committee to think, let's start thinking long term. Let's start thinking about how we create balance so that all of our small businesses in Minnesota win. Right now, we are creating winners and losers. The more and more we push the boundaries, the more and more we push our three-tier system, I have a lot of concern about that. I support the Hillstrom Amendment, and I urge you to vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson. I agree with you. And the moratorium language that we took out was in there for a point. I've heard from not all, but a lot of the members on the committee and other members that aren't on this committee, I think we want to get to a point where we have a final determination. And Ms. Schoenzeit, we don't want to have this happen every year. We'd like it to get to the point where people know this is what kind of a brewery you are to base on it, and we don't want to keep readjusting these numbers. This is a final attempt, I hope, a final attempt to get to a number that all of us can agree to stick to so we don't have to keep coming back and doing this every couple of years.
Further questions? Thank you, testifiers. And to that, to the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Nay.
The demotion does not prevail.
Division.
Division has been called.
Can
you clarify the vote, Mr. Chair?
All those voting. One second.
Just can you clarify the vote so it's on Representative Hillstrom's oral amendment?
Correct. The vote is on Representative Hillstrom's oral amendment to reinsert 20,000 of the 40,000 that was stricken. All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Yep.
All those opposed, please raise your hand. The motion does not prevail. Representative Hillstrom, we're back to your second oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and to the author, I was going to make a motion to delete Section 4, Section 5, and Section 6 of this bill. But it's clear, Mr. Chair, that this is not going to be a bipartisan bill leaving here. And so instead of doing that, I just would ask for a roll call vote on the bill, and I would encourage members to vote no.
Roll call has been requested on the bill. Any further questions to the bill? Anyone else want to testify for or against? And we have a question, and we can make our deadline. Representative Rosenthal, to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not really a question, but Representative Hoppe, I came today planning to vote for this bill, and unfortunately I can't. And I was glad to see that Representative Nash had come to what I thought was a reasonable solution for now for the distillers, and was prepared to vote yes on that. And it was really the Lunin amendment that took it down for me. And so I hope you continue to listen and continue to work on it. But for today, I am a no.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. And I believe we have a couple more testifiers. Come on down. And again, members, we are on the bill, and I'll ask you to stay brief.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Joel Vikra. My wife Emily and I started Vikra Distillery in Duluth, Minnesota, which now employs 25 people, pays a lot of health care, so I enjoyed the previous health care discussion. I want to speak to the Minnesota-made portion of this bill as amended. We are very grateful for the amended version. And in states where craft distilleries are succeeding, basically all three components of the law are here. Cocktail rooms, bottle sales, and then some kind of measure of how authentically local they are. And so doing that last provision is really important. So as it's written, it is done related to where the product is distilled and something else. But in states where it's been successful, the measures written around where the ingredients come from. So I'd like to propose that after the committee, that get rediscussed and amended to reflect as a percentage of the ingredients coming from Minnesota. As it's written, it would conflict with federal law and federal labeling law and be a big regulatory burden for people like us.
Thank you for your testimony. And I believe Mr. Egbert, is that correct?
Yes. Okay. My name is Lee Egbert. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the members of the committee. I also want to thank you for the earlier vote. As a fellow distiller, I really appreciate the that movement. We will truly appreciate that. This is actually coming from my other side. I own Dashfire Cocktail Bitters, and the owner were the first in Minnesota, and established in 2013. And we were actually worried about unintended consequences in this section for the bitters industry, which is kind of a sub-industry of the micro-distilling industry. But my plan today is kind of to testify about those concerns, but I was able to talk to Representative Hoppe and Reynolds today, and I feel a lot better about that. So I'm actually going to keep this really brief and just look forward to future conversations and just kind of stay in the loop on that. So that's pretty much all I have.
Thank you. Comments, Representative Hoppe? Chair Hoppe?
Please vote yes.
Member questions?
No.
Okay. And roll call being requested. We will move to a roll call.
Chair Hoppe?
Aye.
Representative Fenton?
Aye.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Applebaum?
No.
Representative Barr?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Halverson?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kreisha?
Aye.
Representative Loon?
Aye.
Representative Loonen?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Rosenthal? No. Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Swedzinski?
Yeah.
On a vote of 10-7, the motion prevails. The bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you, members.